Centralizētais eksāmens angļu valodā – optimālais mācību satura apguves līmenis.
Hello, this is the listening part of your exam in English. It will consist of three tasks. You will hear the texts twice. Task 1. You have 45 seconds to read the task. Speaker 1.
What I always loved is every Sunday night, my father, he would bring out his big flip chart. He would draw. He would take us kids. He'd kind of put us on a semicircle in the floor. And we were his audience. We were the generals, the congressmen, right? And he even said, hey, you can ask questions. And we did. And we got better as we got older. We test him. And what I loved about it too is, my mom was incredibly intelligent, and she knew this stuff as well as he did. And we as kids, we're like, yeah, because dad was doing great, mom was doing great, we were doing great. And we're watching this presentation, these flips into the next one, and if we threw him a curve, he'd have another drawing to make. And it was just incredible. And it is what made me fall in love with sales and marketing.
Speaker 2.
I went home, I took the cassette tape out and put in the cassette player. I turned it on, and then I opened The Hobbit and started reading. And at the same time, for the first time in my life, the amazing band AC/DC came out of the speaker. So I dove into that literature and so on. That afternoon in the sunshine, in this leather couch that I was lying on, I found my two big passions, which are like fantasy and storytelling and rock and roll music.
Speaker 3.
It was a performance of Cats, and at intermission between acts, I went backstage. I put a frying pan, or like a plastic toy frying pan, on my head, and I picked up a shovel, and I waddled out onto the stage, and banging myself on the head repeatedly with the plastic shovel on the frying pan, and the audience loved it. I just remember this sense that I had delighted these people in a way that they were not expecting. And this was a time in my life when I did not really feel seen. That is why I think this moment of connection with everyone who was there to see Casey's production of Cats was so illuminating for me, and why I have not been able to let go of that feeling.
Speaker 4.
So the summer after my senior year, my parents got into their heads that apparently I should have a job. And I had never really had a real job before. So I just started walking from my house in Alexandria, Virginia toward Old Town. And when I got there, the sort of very, very beginning of Old Town, there was a coffee shop on one side of the street. And on the other side of the street was the Alexandria Gazette. And the coffee shop had a help wanted sign. And there is this moment, right? There's this sort of pivotal moment where I could have turned left and gone into the coffee shop and gotten, you know, a minimum wage job. Instead, I was like, yeah, let me go check out the Gazette. And my memory is that I just walked in and basically said, do you hire people here? I ended up being an intern for the Alexandria Gazette. And it turns out that that was the beginning of a couple of decades in journalism.
Speaker 5.
When I was growing up, I just didn't feel like I was special or extraordinary in any way. There was this theater group, and they loved to put on a pantomime. It was Cinderella, and they were looking for kids. I was a kid, to play a penguin. So I went into the audition room and froze, almost went home. But then a lady, one of the casting directors, said, "It's fine, just try again." I don't know what I did, and I don't know what inspiration struck, but the part was mine. It was the moment that I understood that I can do anything.
Speaker 6.
So when I was 10 years old, I was sitting at the dinner table with what feels in my memory was my entire family. And just remembered that we were all there, and I was sitting watching my brother David at the head of the table, and all he was doing is cracking everyone up in like the most extraordinary way. He was doing this thing with his hands where he was making like a fish face. Just every single thing he did was crushing. And while I was amused by it or laughing at it or loving it, this little moment took place in which I kind of stepped back and looked around at everybody's faces and everybody just like in tears and slapping the table. And I just very distinctly remember thinking, I want to do that.
You have 30 seconds now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time. Speaker 1.
What I always loved is every Sunday night, my father, he would bring out his big flip chart. He would draw. He would take us kids. He'd kind of put us on a semicircle in the floor. And we were his audience. We were the generals, the congressmen, right? And he even said, hey, you can ask questions. And we did. And we got better as we got older. We tested him. And what I loved about it, too, is my mom was incredibly intelligent, and she knew this stuff as well as he did. And we as kids, we're like, yeah, because dad was doing great. Mom was doing great. We were doing great. And we were watching this presentation, these flips into the next one. And if we threw him a curve, he'd have another drawing to make. And it was just incredible. And it is what made me fall in love with sales and marketing.
Speaker 2.
I went home. I took the cassette tape out and put in the cassette player. I turned it on, and then I opened The Hobbit and started reading. And at the same time, for the first time in my life, the amazing band AC/DC came out of the speaker. So I dove into that literature and so on. That afternoon in the sunshine, in this leather couch that I was lying on, I found my two big passions, which are like fantasy and storytelling and rock and roll music.
Speaker 3.
It was a performance of Cats, and at intermission between acts, I went backstage. I put a frying pan or like a plastic toy frying pan on my head, and I picked up a shovel, and I waddled out onto the stage and banging myself on the head repeatedly with the plastic shovel on the frying pan, and the audience loved it. I just remember this sense that I had delighted these people in a way that they were not expecting. And this was a time in my life when I did not really feel seen. That is why I think this moment of connection with everyone who was there to see Casey's production of Cats was so illuminating for me, and why I have not been able to let go of that feeling.
Speaker 4.
So the summer after my senior year, my parents got it into their heads that apparently I should have a job. And I had never really had a real job before. So I just started walking from my house in Alexandria, Virginia toward Old Town. And when I got there, the sort of very, very beginning of Old Town, there was a coffee shop on one side of the street. And on the other side of the street was the Alexandria Gazette. And the coffee shop had a help wanted sign. And there is this moment, right? There's this sort of pivotal moment where I could have turned left and gone into the coffee shop and gotten, you know, a minimum wage job. Instead, I was like, yeah, let me go check out the Gazette. And my memory is that I just walked in and basically said, do you hire people here? I ended up being an intern for the Alexandria Gazette. And it turns out that that was the beginning of a couple of decades in journalism.
Speaker 5.
When I was growing up, I just didn't feel like I was special or extraordinary in any way. there was this theater group and they loved to put on a pantomime. It was Cinderella, and they were looking for kids. I was a kid, to play a penguin. So I went into the audition room and froze, almost went home. But then a lady, one of the casting directors, said, "It's fine, just try again." I don't know what I did, and I don't know what inspiration struck, but the part was mine. It was the moment that I understood that I can do anything.
Speaker 6.
So when I was 10 years old, I was sitting at the dinner table with what feels in my memory was my entire family. And just remembered that we were all there, and I was sitting watching my brother David at the head of the table, and all he was doing is cracking everyone up in like the most extraordinary way. He was doing this thing with his hands where he was making like a fish face. Just every single thing he did was crushing. And while I was amused by it or laughing at it or loving it, this little moment took place in which I kind of stepped back and looked around at everybody's faces and everybody just like in tears and slapping the table. And I just very distinctly remember thinking, I want to do that.
You have 30 seconds now to finish the task. This is the end of task one. Go on to task two. You have 1 minute to read the task.
Today, we would like to take you back to 2005 and the launch of an internet service that is now used by over 1 billion people across the globe. On the 8th of February, 2005, the world awoke to a game-changing new feature on the Google search engine, the launch of Google Maps, something that Lars Rasmussen, one of its original creators, says was partly possible because they were at the right place at the right time. While it took a while to get the project up and running, Lars says it is a tremendous source of pride and joy for him. Born in Denmark, Lars moved to California in the 90s to study at Berkeley, which at the time was a hotbed of new tech ideas. There was a dot-com bubble with quite a few web companies starting up, and several of those were started by academics. One of Lars's professors spotted his potential, and just as Lars graduated, he was hired as an engineer. Lars persuaded his brother, Jens, then living in Denmark, to come to California and join him on the startup scene. They started working together. However, a few years later, the bubble burst and they both got laid off. Unable to find work elsewhere and having no savings, Lars's brother Jens decided that the two of them needed to invent something. They settled on the already crowded space of mapping and navigation and set to work on building something that nobody was doing at the time. Before 2005, maps on the internet were similar to old-fashioned atlases. Jens's idea was to develop an application that would not only display static maps, but provide people with a searchable map. You would be able to zoom in and zoom out, and information would appear on the map as you moved around the map with your cursor. In a BBC interview, Lars says that the geography of a place on the map was important, but it wasn't just about getting driving directions. People would also like to know, for example, which cinema to go to and where it is relative to the restaurant. You might think that Lars himself has always been good at finding his way around, but in fact, he says that he has no sense of direction whatsoever, and he consistently gets lost. Two developers in Sydney who were friends with the brothers invited them to Sydney to work. Sydney was where they'd stay for the next 6 months, and that's where maps really started to take shape. When they had a compelling prototype ready, the team started approaching investors. They did find one investor that seemed interested, but the deal was never signed. Another major player released a similar product, so the investor withdrew from the deal. They were devoting all of their resources to the new mapping software and were running out of money. They decided to approach Google, whose founder, Larry Page, was keen, but unsure the maps would be suitable for the company, as they worked as an application you'd need to download. Luckily, a new technology had just been invented, which could allow the team to adapt the maps to a web browser. The team worked feverishly for 3 weeks, came back with what was really Google Maps, and were bought by the company. The rest is history.
You have 1 minute to check your work, then you will hear the text a second time.
Today, we would like to take you back to 2005 and the launch of an internet service that is now used by over 1 billion people across the globe. On the 8th of February, 2005, the world awoke to a game-changing new feature on the Google search engine, the launch of Google Maps, something that Lars Rasmussen, one of its original creators, says was partly possible because they were at the right place at the right time. While it took a while to get the project up and running, Lars says it is a tremendous source of pride and joy for him. Born in Denmark, Lars moved to California in the 90s to study at Berkeley, which at the time was a hotbed of new tech ideas. There was a dot-com bubble with quite a few web companies starting up, and several of those were started by academics. One of Lars's professors spotted his potential, and just as Lars graduated, he was hired as an engineer. Lars persuaded his brother, Jens, then living in Denmark, to come to California and join him on the startup scene. They started working together. However, a few years later, the bubble burst and they both got laid off. Unable to find work elsewhere and having no savings, Lars's brother, Jens, decided that the two of them needed to invent something. They settled on the already crowded space of mapping and navigation and set to work on building something that nobody was doing at the time. Before 2005, maps on the internet were similar to old-fashioned atlases. Jens's idea was to develop an application that would not only display static maps, but provide people with a searchable map. You would be able to zoom in and zoom out, and information would appear on the map as you moved around the map with your cursor. In a BBC interview, Lars says that the geography of a place on the map was important, but it wasn't just about getting driving directions. People would also like to know, for example, which cinema to go to and where it is relative to the restaurant. You might think that Lars himself has always been good at finding his way around. But in fact, he says that he has no sense of direction whatsoever, and he consistently gets lost. Two developers in Sydney who were friends with the brothers invited them to Sydney to work. Sydney was where they'd stay for the next 6 months, and that's where maps really started to take shape. When they had a compelling prototype ready, the team started approaching investors. They did find one investor that seemed interested, but the deal was never signed. Another major player released a similar product, so the investor withdrew from the deal. They were devoting all of their resources to the new mapping software and were running out of money. They decided to approach Google, whose founder, Larry Page, was keen, but unsure the maps would be suitable for the company, as they worked as an application you'd need to download. Luckily, a new technology had just been invented, which could allow the team to adapt the maps to a web browser. The team worked feverishly for 3 weeks, came back with what was really Google Maps, and were bought by the company. The rest is history.
You have 1 minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task 2. Go on to task 3. You have 1 minute to read the task.
So how'd you sleep last night? The answer is never simple for the 70 million or so Americans who suffer from sleep disorders, such as insomnia. Among those struggling to get a good night's sleep is Atlantic staff writer Derek Thompson, whose search for answers to his own sleep issues led to some pretty interesting sleep history. His latest article in The Atlantic is called "Can Medieval Sleeping Habit Fix America's Insomnia?" Derek, welcome, and we want to hear about the medieval part, of course, but first, how'd you sleep last night?
I slept pretty well. I watched some great NFL games, and honestly, I was so exhausted by how exciting that they were that I was ready to fall asleep for 7 consecutive hours, which I suppose, as we're about to talk about, is not a historical norm necessarily.
Yes. So you found a sleep historian who's been writing about this practice for a few decades. It turns out that this kind of sleep pattern, which is a medieval pattern, has been happening all over the world for a long time. Tell us what it is and how long it's been going on.
That's right. So today, most people think about sleep as something you're supposed to get in one big chunk of 6, 7, 8, 9 hours. But for hundreds of years in Europe, according to the historian Roger Eckerge, people slept in 2 segments. It's thus called segmented sleep. They would fall asleep around nightfall, and then they would wake up in the middle of the night for a bit of an intermission that the French called dormir, for wake sleep. And then after a few hours of working or chatting by the fire, they would go back to sleep for second sleep. And Eckerge found information or found proof of these, of this segmented sleep, not only in Europe, but really around the world, which has opened up modern eyes to the fact that before the Industrial Revolution, there was not one sleep, but 2. Some people, I think, looking back to pre-industrial Europe, assume, well, if that's how they slept before artificial light, if that's how they slept before the modern workday, well, surely that must be the best way to sleep. But it turns out when you dig a little bit deeper into the story, you realize 2 things that are really fascinating. Number one, even though pre-industrial Europe seemed to enjoy segmented sleep, we now have some evidence that suggests that hunter-gatherers from around the world actually have slept for hundreds and maybe thousands of years in one phase. Not only that, but there's also been some attempts to try to restore segmented or two or biphasic six sleep for modern adults. And they found that people who sleep in two segments don't necessarily sleep better. So what I find so interesting about this is that on the one hand, you have the illumination, so to speak, of this pre-modern history of sleep, segmented sleep. But also you dig deeper and you realize just because that practice is old doesn't necessarily mean that it's better. In fact, any kind, the human body seems so flexible when it comes to sleep that just about any single strategy you have, as long as there is a routine behind it, has the possibility of serving as a restful sleep.
So wait a minute. So it doesn't matter if you're getting all the sleep in 1 7-hour dose or a first sleep and a second sleep divided?
That's exactly what I'm saying, is that based on my reading of the evidence and based on my understanding of history, if you're trying to summarize sort of the total research literature of sleep, sleep itself is very, very flexible depending on what you're trying to get out of it. What's most important is that you set up a routine and stick to it as much as possible.
You have 1 minute to check your work, then you will hear the text a second time.
So how'd you sleep last night? The answer is never simple for the 70 million or so Americans who suffer from sleep disorders such as insomnia. Among those struggling to get a good night's sleep is Atlantic staff writer Derek Thompson, whose search for answers to his own sleep issues led to some pretty interesting sleep history. His latest article in The Atlantic is called Can Medieval Sleeping Habit Fix America's Insomnia? Derek, welcome, and we want to hear about the medieval part, of course, but first, how'd you sleep last night?
I slept pretty well. I watched some great NFL games, and honestly, I was so exhausted by how exciting that they were that I was ready to fall asleep for 7 consecutive hours, which I suppose, as we're about to talk about, is not a historical norm necessarily.
Yes. So you found a sleep historian who's been writing about this practice for a few decades. It turns out that this kind of sleep pattern, which is a medieval pattern, has been happening all over the world for a long time. Tell us what it is and how long it's been going on.
That's right. So today, most people think about sleep as something you're supposed to get in one big chunk of 6, 7, 8, 9 hours. But for hundreds of years in Europe, according to the historian Roger Eckerge, people slept in two segments. It's thus called segmented sleep. They would fall asleep around nightfall, and then they would wake up in the middle of the night for a bit of an intermission that the French called dormir, for wake sleep. And then after a few hours of working or chatting by the fire, they would go back to sleep for second sleep. And Eckerge found information or found proof of these of this segmented sleep, not only in Europe, but really around the world, which has opened up modern eyes to the fact that before the Industrial Revolution, there was not one sleep, but two. Some people, I think, looking back to pre-industrial Europe, assume, well, if that's how they slept before artificial light, if that's how they slept before the modern workday, well, surely that must be the best way to sleep. But it turns out when you dig a little bit deeper into the story, you realize two things that are really fascinating. Number one, even though pre-industrial Europe seemed to enjoy segmented sleep, we now have some evidence that suggests that hunter-gatherers from around the world actually have slept for hundreds and maybe thousands of years in one phase. Not only that, but there's also been some attempts to try to restore segmented or two or biphasic sleep for modern adults. And they found that people who sleep in two segments don't necessarily sleep better. So what I find so interesting about this is that on the one hand, you have the illumination, so to speak, of this pre-modern history of sleep, segmented sleep. But also you dig deeper and you realize just because that practice is old doesn't necessarily mean that it's better. In fact, any kind, the human body seems so flexible when it comes to sleep that just about any single strategy you have, as long as there is a routine behind it, has the possibility of serving as a restful sleep.
So wait a minute. So it doesn't matter if you're getting all the sleep in 1 7-hour dose or a first sleep and a second sleep divided?
That's exactly what I'm saying, is that based on my reading of the evidence and based on my understanding of history, if you're trying to summarize sort of the total research literature of sleep, sleep itself is very, very flexible depending on what you're trying to get out of it. What's most important is that you set up a routine and stick to it as much as possible.
You have 1 minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task 3 and the whole listening test.